In order to access the divine child appropriately, we need to acknowledge him, but not identify with him. We need to love and admire the creativity and beauty of this primal aspect of the masculine self, because if we don't have this connection with him, we are never going to see the possibilities in life. We are never going to seize opportunities for newness and freshness. Therapists often depreciate the grandiose self within their clients. Although it is necessary at times for clients to gain emotional and cognitive distance from the divine child, we ourselves have not encountered many men, at least among those who seek therapy, who identify with their creativity. Rather, they usually need to get in touch with it. We want to encourage greatness in men. We want to encourage ambition. We believe that nobody really wants to be sort of gray normal. Often, the definition of normal is average. We live, it seems to us, in an age under the curse of normalcy, characterized by the elevation of the mediocre. It seems likely that therapists who persistently depreciate the shining of the grandiose self in their clients are themselves split off from their own divine child. They are envying the beauty and freshness, the creativity and vitality of the child in their clients. The ancient Romans believed that every human baby is born with what they called his or her genius, a guardian spirit assigned at birth. Roman birthday parties were held not so much to honor an individual as to honor that person's genius, the divine being that came into the world with him or her. The Romans knew that it was not the man's ego that was the source of his music, his art, his statecraft, or his courageous deeds. It was the divine child, an aspect of the self within him. We need to ask ourselves two questions. The first one is not whether we are manifesting the high chair tyrant or the weakling prince, but how, because we are all manifesting both to some extent and in some form. At the very least, we all do this when we regress into our child, when we are fatigued or extremely frightened. The second question is not whether the creative child exists in us, but how we are honoring him or not honoring him. If we're not feeling him in our personal lives and in our work, then we have to ask ourselves how we are blocking him. The archetype of the precocious child manifests in a boy when he is eager to learn, when his mind is quickened, when he wants to share what he is learning with others. There's a glint in his eye and an energy of body and mind that shows he is adventuring in the world of ideas. This boy, and later the man, wants to know the why of everything. He asks his parents, "Why is the sky blue? Why do the leaves fall? Why do things have to die?" He wants to know the how of things, the what and the where. He often learns to read at an early age so that he can answer his own questions. He's usually a good student and an eager participant in class discussions. Often this boy is also talented in one or more areas. He may be able to draw and paint well or play a musical instrument with proficiency. He may also be good at sports. The precocious child is the source of so-called child prodigies. The precocious child is the origin of our curiosity and our adventurous impulses. He urges us to be explorers and pioneers of the unknown, the strange and mysterious. He causes us to wonder at the world around us and the world inside of us. A boy for whom the precocious child is a powerful influence wants to know what makes other people tick as well as what makes himself tick. He wants to know why people act the way they do, why he has the feelings he has. He tends to be introverted and reflective, and he is able to see the hidden connections in things. He can achieve cognitive detachment from the people around him long before his peers are able to accomplish this. Though introverted and reflective, he is also extroverted and eagerly reaches out to others to share his insights and his talents with them. The precocious child in a man keeps his sense of wonder and curiosity alive, stimulates his intellect, and moves him in the direction of the mature magician. The bipolar shadow of the precocious child, like all the shadow forms of the archetypes of the immature masculine, can be carried over into adulthood, where it causes would-be men to manifest inappropriate infantilism in their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. The know-it-all trickster is, as the name implies, that immature masculine energy that plays tricks of a more or less serious nature in one's own life and on others. He is expert at creating appearances and then selling us on those appearances. He seduces people into believing him, and then he pulls the rug out from under them. He gets us to believe in him, to trust him, and then he betrays us and laughs at our misery. He is the practical joker, adept at making fools of us. He is a manipulator. The know-it-all is that aspect of the trickster in a boy or man that enjoys intimidating others. The boy or man, under the power of the know-it-all, shoots off his mouth a lot. He's always got his hand up in class, not because he wants to participate in the discussion, but because he wants his classmates to understand that he is more intelligent than they are. The boy or man, under the power of the know-it-all, makes many enemies. He is verbally abusive of others, whom he regards as his inferiors. As a result, in grade school, he can often be found on the bottom of a pile of angry boys who are whacking away at him. He comes away from these encounters with black eyes, but with a defiant conviction of his own superiority. The know-it-all man, who is still possessed by this infantile shadow form of the precocious child, is characteristically smug and often wears a cocky grin. He frequently dominates conversations, turning friendly discussions into lectures and arguments into diatribes. He depreciates those who don't know what he knows or who hold opinions that differ from his. Because the trickster is the umbrella complex under which the know-it-all operates, the man caught in this infantile influence is usually deceiving others, and perhaps himself as well, about the depth of his knowledge or the level of his importance. But he also has a positive side. He is very good at deflating egos, our own and those of others, and often we need deflating. He can spot in an instant when and in exactly what way we are inflated and identified with our own grandiosity, and he goes for it in order to reduce us to human size and expose to us all our frailties. How does the trickster work? Let's say you are preparing to give what you regard as the most brilliant presentation of your life. You're so proud of your special insights. You sit down at the computer and order it to print out the notes you had put into it earlier, and the printer doesn't work. Your own inner trickster has tricked you. Or you're going to make an appearance at an important function. You're timing it so that you know everyone will be waiting for you just for a few minutes, just long enough for them to realize how important you are. You go to the car at last, preparing to make your triumphal journey, and you can't find your keys. There they are, locked in the car, still in the ignition. Hubris leads to nemesis. This is how the trickster works against us, and in the long run, perhaps, for us. But he works through us against others, too. Maybe you're the practical joker, mercilessly hounding others with your pranks until someone does you one better and you are forced to realize how much it hurts. We need to understand this immature energy. Though its purpose in its positive mode seems to be to expose lies, if it is left unchecked, it moves into its negative side and becomes destructive, of oneself and others. For the negative side of this immature masculine energy is really hostile and depreciating of all the real effort, all the rights, all the beauty of others. The trickster, like the high chair tyrant, does not want to do anything himself. He does not want to honestly earn anything. He just wants to be, and to be what he has no right to be. He is, in psychological language, passive-aggressive. This is the energy form that seeks the fall of great men, that delights in the destruction of a man of importance. But the trickster does not want to replace the man who has fallen. He does not want to take up that man's responsibilities. In fact, he doesn't want any responsibilities. He wants to do just enough to wreck things for others. The trickster causes a boy, or a boyish man, to have an authority problem. Such a boy, or man, can always find a man to hate him and eventually shoot him down. He will readily believe that all men in power are corrupt and abusive. Like the man possessed by the weakling prince, he is condemned forever to be on the outskirts of life, never able to take responsibility for himself or his actions. His energy comes from envy. The less a man is in touch with his true talents and abilities, the more he will envy others. If we envy a lot, we are denying our own realistic greatness, our own divine child. What we need to do then is to get in touch with our own specialness, our own beauty, and our own creativity. Envy blocks creativity. The trickster is the archetype that rushes in to fill the vacuum in the immature man or boy left by the boy's denial of and lack of connection with the divine child. The trickster gets activated developmentally within us when we have been depreciated and attacked by our parents or older siblings, or when we have been emotionally abused. If we don't feel our real specialness, we will come under the power of the trickster, the know-it-all, and deflate others' sense of their specialness, even when such deflation is not called for. The know-it-all trickster has no heroes, because to have heroes is to admire others. We can only admire others if we have a sense of our own worthiness and a developing sense of security about our own creative energies.